Chats, the show where I, Josh Pinkford, founder of Baremetrics, hop on a call with my founder pals and get the stories of how they started and grew their businesses. This week, I talk with Jesse Meacham of You Need a Budget, where they help people get out of debt and get control of their money. We talk about how he majored in accounting on a whim, sold downloadable spreadsheets to pay rent, and switched from one-time payments to subscription, and a whole lot more. Hope you enjoy it. Jesse, thanks for joining me here.
Absolutely. I'm excited. It's been a long time.
It has. It really has. So I kind of like to jump in with these things, starting with like a little bit of history to give some context. And I'm personally kind of fascinated by not so much company, but like personal sort of origin stories, like how you got into stuff.
Yeah.
So I guess I would love to hear kind of like what you as a kid were like, were you an entrepreneurial type or like, what were you like as a kid?
As a kid, you know, I never thought I was much of an entrepreneurial kind of person. But looking back and kind of, you know, in hindsight, I realized that I was a bit of a promoter. Mm-hmm. And I, way back, like in seventh grade, someone was mentioning like Jabot jeans the other day and I looked on eBay, they still sell them. So like, I should pick up a pair of those things. But that was kind of the time. And you'd wear these big wide jeans and I would rollerblade everywhere and do crazy tricks. And, you know, like that whole scene, that was my deal when I was like sixth, seventh grade.
So wait, so you were wearing Jabots?
Oh, I had, no, I had knockoffs because no way I could convince my parents to pay that much.
I have a funny story about those. I was in sixth grade and I mean, I am at this point like short, chubby. I've got just the thickest glasses possible. And I'm sitting across the table from, a kid who had like just bought a pair. I mean, like they were, that was his first day. And I, like they used to serve like grape juice in like what is equivalent, the equivalent of like an applesauce. There's like a peel off.
Yeah. You have to peel them off.
Metal. Yeah. And so I'm peeling it off and it slips and I spill grape juice all over. And I mean, that was one of those things like, you know, where I'm in like a public school, the lunchroom's got like 8,000 kids in it and everybody goes like, ooh, and I would just cower down, like really just wanted to die. So that's
your Jabot jeans experience.
Yes.
So this that's the scene that we have is kids that care a lot about, you know, their brand and stuff.
Right.
I had to wear wide pants because you had to get them over your knee pads and you had to get over your skates because we would do like half pipes and crazy things that kind of make my blood pressure go up thinking about it now. But I did remember I wanted to organize a competition. And back at that time, there was no like scene for us, especially not in Arizona. And so what we were doing, people had never seen before. And there weren't a lot of kids that were into it. And so I contacted a few manufacturers, like wheels manufacturers or guys that did bearings and things. And I totally lied. I was just like, oh, I'm part of the something something skating association here in Arizona, and we just wanted you to sponsor this competition. And I wrote them all letters, and then they called me on the phone, like called my house. My mom's like, Meekums. It's like, oh, you want to talk to Jesse? Like, it was so random, but they bought it apparently, or they didn't care, one of the two.
Sure.
So I tried to pretend I was like this head of this skating association, but they sponsored it, sent us a bunch of stuff. And then once I had the stuff, I was like, I got to really throw this thing now, you know?
Yeah.
So I promoted it like crazy and we held it in the parking lot of my elementary school without getting permission from a single soul. And, I remember the principal like pulls up. And there's like probably 80 or 90 kids there. And like these ramps are rolled in and like it was crazy town. And he comes in, good old Mr. Hammond, you know, comes in and he's like, hey, Jesse, next time, could you ask before you do this? Like the damage was done. Like there's no way he would pull all those kids off. But so that was my first experience where I was like, oh, I am a bit of a promoter, you know, and a lot of entrepreneurial stuff. I mean, you're a promoter. You're promoting to your team. You're promoting your vision, promoting your product. So a little bit in my blood, maybe more than I originally appreciated.
Is that something that you feel like carried, like stuck with you? I mean, all through growing up, or did you not do that for a while, or is it like you felt like you were always kind of like into something and like wanting to like figure out how to make it bigger or convince people to do something? Or
I would do it, but not in like a grand sense. I'm always trying to convince someone of something, and usually it's like the, you know, whether it's this new fad or that thing, whatever I'm interested in at the moment, I preach it to people, and not like preachy, but I just love chatting about it and stuff. So right now I'm into like mobility and trying to improve my flexibility. So of course someone mentions like anything and I somehow tie it back to, you know, like, oh yeah, your flexibility. And they're like, dude, I wasn't talking about that at all. Why'd you bring that up? So I just get into this, yeah, like mostly one-on-one where you're chatting with someone and I've got whatever's on my mind and I promote it. So it's just kind of my nature. But
so you're a promoter and then you've got, and I mean, jumping the chasm a little bit. So there's sort of YNAB, which is budgeting software. So like, now how do we make the transition from you, Jesse, as the promoter growing up, and then, you know, presumably you go to college.
Yeah.
Right. And did you major in accounting or something?
I did, yeah. I got a master's degree in accounting, and my thinking along the lines of I served a church mission. So I had kind of a 2-year hiatus. I was over in Germany, come back. And I had only done like a semester of school beforehand. So I jump right in and I'm pretty focused and thinking, okay, what do I do? And I went to Brigham Young University and they had a top of the country, like top 3 accounting program. So my thinking was, oh, that's clearly like one of the best programs in the country. So I don't really know anything about accounting, but I'm going to do that because it's top notch. So that was my whole process was, this is quality. I want to see quality.
Wait. Hold on. You chose accounting because you just happened to be at a school that had a good accounting program?
Exactly. Yeah. Because I just figured, like, education wise, whoever knows their stuff the best, that's where I want to go. I want to learn from the best of the best. And it happened that, and it still is the case today. They run a phenomenal accounting program over there for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah.
So I picked that. Yeah. Like, if they would have said, oh, you know, basket weaving, we're number one in the world. I'm like, wait, seriously?
Done.
Yeah. Okay. Let's do this. So there wasn't a lot of thinking to it. I like, oh, do I like this? Is this my passion? None of that was in there. I saw it as like a very straight path. Also, it really scratched like my big time conservative side where I thought, well, anyone can get a job if they're an accountant, you know,
sure.
Looks super safe. And it is, as far as I know. So yeah, I picked the safe bet with the safe program that was really, you know, really vetted. And then hustled as fast as I could to finish up school. So during that time, that's when I started YNAB, was kind of in the throes of my accounting schooling.
And were you married while you were at Brigham Young?
Yeah, I got married super young. I was like 10. No, I'm
illegal in some states.
It's a very weird culture thing. But so I got back to school and started out. I mean, I had all of my schooling left when I met Julie. By the time I got married, I think I had 3 years. Yeah, 3 years left to finish my master's degree. So we were in it together, poor and focused. So
I've heard parts of the story before about kind of like how YNAB came to be and how it was just this like basically random spreadsheets that you were kind of hacking together.
Yeah.
And, how did you come up with a system at all? I mean, like how did systematizing like personal accounting, like how does that even come about?
Yeah. So I didn't come up with the system first. First, I came up with the spreadsheet out of pure necessity for me and Julie. And, we were broke. Most like young married and you happen to be students, you're going to be broke. And so we were that. And, I just kind of started constructing this spreadsheet cause I'd had a spreadsheet class and I thought, well, that's pretty good at like adding numbers up and things like that. So I used that and Julie's okay with it. She's like, yeah, we can use that to kind of track our money. And she was on board. So after about a year of just her and her using it and we were together kind of just figuring stuff out. And then we realized that it was working pretty well for us despite super meager income. And that was when, a baby came into the picture and that was why I thought I got to make some extra money.
Those things eat money.
Oh, they do. Like they eat really like pureed food and then money. Those two things.
That's it. Yeah.
So, So Porter, my first, he was the big impetus to like, I got to make some side money. That was my whole, you know, the whole thinking. So not thinking, oh, I'm going to start a company, nothing, nothing like that. Just, could I make enough to cover rent was my big question.
Yeah. So you've been using a spreadsheet, you decide you need some side money and you think maybe I can sell the spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Right.
So I go to Julie and I'm like, I think we could sell this. There was another guy selling a spreadsheet for $10 online that I'd found. So I was like, clearly, like, market research check, you know, that's done.
And what year is this?
This was 2004, middle of 2004.
Okay. Gotcha.
And Porter will arrive in June, and I'm kind of thinking, okay, gotta get this thing rolling before he comes. So I asked Joy, I said, should I sell this? And she said, I don't think anyone will buy it. And so I ignored that. And then I was talking with my buddy on the bus on our way home, and I asked him, and he said, oh yeah, you could definitely sell it, but you got to sell it for $20, not 10, like I was thinking. And so that was it. I was all the validation I needed, and I got it ready for market and learned how to build a web page and paste a PayPal button onto the web page, and we were off. Made no sales until I doubled my price, which has always been kind of an interesting thinking experiment. But
so it's you're $20 a month. Wait, sorry, what, you didn't make any sales until you made it 40?
I made it. It was, I started at 10, and then he said,
oh,
no,
and then you doubled it.
Yeah, double it. Okay, so I started selling them, and they would sell at like 20. And when I say sell, I mean maybe, I think 6 months in, I had a month where I profited like $90. So,
okay.
I mean, we're talking like, you know, nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so even at that point where you're making very few sales, where are those coming from? Like, who's buying it?
Honestly, I remember the first lady, I know her email still, I could email her now. She bought, there were a few other people, but I had really no clue who it was. I had no sophistication around who my customer was or anything like that. I was simply saying, here's a spreadsheet, here's how it works. You might want it, it's worked for us. And then as I redid my website early in 2005, that was where I systematized it, or basically sold it as a system instead of a spreadsheet, and sales doubled, from small to small, but they doubled nonetheless. And that system where we had these four rules, that suddenly became this marketable thing that carved out a little bit of a niche for us, made us different than anything else.
Yep. And so, I guess I'm still curious about the initial customers. I mean, because a lot of times what you hear is, you know, friends and family kind of thing, or, you know, if you're still in school kind of doing some of this stuff, like maybe it's around school, you're able to like promote it a little bit or something. But I mean, are this is on the internet and like random people are somehow finding you on like Google?
I acquired them through AdWords. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
So that was, I mean, I did try and blanket my apartment complex with flyers, and that did not work. So then I tried the internet, and that worked. I mean, back then, like, I would never give someone advice now saying, oh yeah, you can get traffic through AdWords.
Oh, sure.
It's brutal.
It's like, insanely expensive.
At that time, I mean, I was paying, I'm sure, 5, 6, 7 cents a click. And, I remember I spent $63 to try and test, would people buy this? And that money validated that, you know, the numbers worked.
Yep.
And I got from there. So it was, I mean, I guess AdWords is still a good place to test viability, but boy, it's tricky once you want to try and scale or anything like that.
For sure. So, okay. So you've got the beginnings of the system in place. You've got some kind of, you know, something that you can kind of market, because that it's easier to kind of tell a story around that than a spreadsheet. But at this point, is the product that people are buying still ultimately a spreadsheet?
Yes, you would just never say that, but yes, it was.
Right.
Yeah, as far as like, what are we building behind the scenes? And by we, I mean I. It was
spreadsheet.
Absolutely.
Like we're talking like download an Excel file kind of thing?
Yeah, and please don't share it with people. That kind
right. I'm begging you. Right. I've got this newborn who's, you're basically taking the food right out of their mouth.
Yeah. He's starving. He's starving right now. You know?
Okay. So at what point did you make the transition from downloadable Excel file to downloadable app?
Taylor reached out to me, who's now my CTO. He reached out to me in February of 06. So I ended up selling the spreadsheet for about 2 years. And to give people context on how it was growing, at the spreadsheet's best, we were probably doing, I think, maybe $6,000 or $7,000 in profit per month. So it was still just a little one-man interesting side gig, right?
But presumably it's paying enough to cover some bills.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wasn't right. even entertaining the idea of living off of it. I was working full, working part-time while I was in school. Then I graduated from school and took a job at a big accounting firm. So I had no idea or even thinking around, when could I do this full-time? Wasn't yep. even on my radar.
Okay, gotcha.
It was still.
So Taylor reaches out, I mean, just out of nowhere, like randomly?
Yeah, he was looking for a solution to his finances. Like, he's like, hey, I'm married and my wife and I, like, we want to be able to, be on the same page. So that was his original just Googling around. And then luckily he found me and he liked the rules. Mm-hmm. And he wrote to me and said, hey, I'm a developer and I could make the spreadsheet do far more. And I wrote back and said, well, why don't we just build software instead of doing the spreadsheet at all? And so he and I went back and forth for a while on just chatting. And then we got an agreement where I would just pay him per milestone, kind of standard stuff. Yep. And he would ship. And he wrote and shipped our first app. We started it we met over the phone February of 06 and then launched it in November of 06. So it worked out. And once we launched that, then I thought, oh, this is making pretty good money. I mean, we probably quadrupled profits with, software that was actually good.
So what was the big difference there, do you feel like, between the spreadsheet versus the app? I mean, because at that point, is the app's not just like a container around a spreadsheet. I mean, like,
No, not at all. Yeah, totally from the ground up written. And we did steal some interface ideas from the spreadsheet. Spreadsheets are killer on interface. Right. And we stole some stuff there. But it had reports. It had, you could drop in a bank import so you didn't have to add all the transactions manually. It's just, niceties. And then the whole use experience is obviously better around installing and having an icon versus some random spreadsheet. So the value proposition definitely went up, for the visitor.
So what are you were selling the spreadsheet before the app for how much at that point? Like
that was still $20.
$20. Okay, and then how much were you selling the app for?
And then we launched the app for $34.95. And then quickly bumped it to $39. And then at our peak with that app in a much further iteration, we were selling it for $60.
Gotcha. So $60 was like the top.
Yeah, that was like a couple years ago. We were doing $60.
Right. Okay, so by the time, I mean, obviously, you mentioned quadrupling how much that thing's making. So, I mean, at what point do you go full time on one app?
It was kind of late 07.
Okay, so not that long after, I mean, within a year of launching the app.
Yes. Well, I took a little consulting gig on the side to kind of help my mind be at ease.
Yeah.
And then a buddy and I also were doing some stuff on the side with like buying and selling websites back when it was easy.
Yep.
And so we were doing that. I didn't go, like, if you're just to say eat, drink, sleep, wine app, like total focus, that wasn't until 09, like late 09.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. So by the time you're going full time on wine app, I mean, like, what a lot of times when you've got a family, because I mean, and you've had a family early on, not even just your wife, but I mean, kids came pretty early too. So, I mean, what was that conversation like with Julie about saying, like, hey, I'm not doing any other side stuff, I'm just focusing on YNAB?
Yeah, she did. This doesn't, I don't mean this to sound trite, but she doesn't care, right? So, sure. The best, like, a testament to her, one, she grew up having to be super frugal by necessity. So I always knew that, like, our expenses were in check, and just her nature is one of being pretty content. So when we were doing the spreadsheet, I'm piling up this money because remember, this is like 04, 05. So like real estate is starting to become this really big deal. And we're wanting to get into a house and graduate and thinking, oh my gosh, we'll never be able to buy a, buy a house because prices were just on this rocket ship. And so I remember conversations with us at the time being like, we got to save for a down payment, save up, get into something fast and get ahead of the curve. And so all this money that the spreadsheet was making, maybe it was 1500, 2000, 4500 bucks a month. I said, oh, that's all for the down payment. And she's like, great, we're making progress. And then I'm working and we're using that money to, to survive. Then Taylor comes along and I start introducing this, thinking about the idea of the software. And it was basically going to take away the down payment. So I go to her, like, hey, Julie, the down payment we've been saving up and that's for the house. Like, what if instead we paid this guy down in Dallas that I've never met to do this software? And she was like, do you think it'll work? And I said, yeah. And so she's like, okay, yeah, let's do that. So it was cool because, she rolls the dice. So when I say she doesn't care, I think she has pretty good guts for the most part, pretty good instinct. And she always calls me on stuff that's off base.
Sure.
And she's been able to go with the flow, over the time that we've, you've probably done the same thing, Josh, where it's like, there's always this thing on the horizon. You're like,
Right.
and Julie's like, you realize like my whole married life to you is like, and then when I graduate, and then when I become a
Oh,
partner in this
man.
accounting firm, and then we switch. It's like, and then when we launch this app, and then, and like the last 2 years are like, and then when we finally launch this SaaS model, like she's just like, yeah, all I know is there's always something else you're doing. And as long as the kids are fed, we're good to go,
Yep.
So.
Well, I mean, we're the same way with Ashley and I, because it's like we haven't ever had any real, I mean, tangible stability, only because the longest we ever had this like stable, I'm not like me not just trying something random, was we had been married for like a week, and we moved out to Colorado from Mississippi. And had no jobs, just graduated college, and just we all, I guess we were like, hey, we should probably get jobs. So she went and got a job. I went and got a job. I lasted at that job for 7 weeks and then didn't look back. So,
Yeah.
I mean, it's always been this, like, if you looked at like our graphed our income, I mean, it has never, except for the past couple of years of Barometrics, ever been stable. Like,
Yeah.
and even the past like couple of years of Barometrics have been all over the place. So,
Yeah. Well, what happens is like you say like there's no stability, but we all like if you're doing things right and you're working hard and you're being productive, and I don't mean in the income sense, I just mean like are you building relationships? Are
right.
you learning things? Like stability is in your knowledge, in your network, in your work ethic. That's where the stability lies. And so whenever someone's they'll come to me, and I'm sure they do this to you, where it's like, oh man, you've made the big leap. And I always am caught like, I didn't feel like I was making this
There's
big
never a
leap.
leap.
Like I just kind of stepped where it was pretty obvious where the next step should be. I never like had this big roll of the dice. It doesn't feel that way. Or they'll ask you really nitty gritty questions like, how do you do health insurance? Or how do you, and you're like, you just buy it. Like,
You should just
it's
go and
not
spend
that
money.
crazy. So I feel like they need to recognize that stability comes from like your work ethic, your knowledge, your network. But like whether you're on a W-2 or not for a certain company, I mean, my word, you
Oh,
never know
sure.
what could happen beyond
Well,
that.
it's just the difference. I forget who it was. I heard somebody saying the other day, like, there's no such thing as like actual job security.
Right.
It's just like you can, when you're working for yourself, you just like you're seeing how the sausage is made, right? Like, so you
Yeah.
can see how unstable it could be. Whereas, like, when you're working for someone else, you kind of just offload that and you don't see the ups and downs,
Yeah, exactly. My guess would be like when you're kind of seeing how the sausage is made, you probably have more notice if things are going to go south than the person where they announce that
Oh,
there are
sure. This
layoffs.
gets.
You know what I mean? Like, anyway,
Right, totally.
but yeah, so it's never as scary as people think it's going to be. Things aren't as stable as they appear at the moment. That kind of thing, I think, is true.
Yep.
But man, I was so afraid to go like quote unquote full time. I was just not programmed to do that. It took this guy who was a very successful business owner. I told him, I'm like, I'm making this much at my accounting job, 70 hours a week. I'm making this much over here on this side gig that I work on from 4 to 5 a.m. So like, what do you think? And he's like, dude, are you stupid? Like, you're making four times the accounting job. It was insane. But I had to have someone like kind of smack me a little bit and be like, come on, man, like, go for it. You have zero risk. You have little kids, no debt, no mortgage. You're not bound to anything. Go for it. So,
well, and especially, I mean, if you think back, like, you chose the really safe route. Like,
yeah,
that was sort of what came natural to you. It was like, I'm just gonna choose the safest thing. And so changing to something that isn't the, at least culturally, safe route,
Yeah. It was tough.
So I'm curious about what do you think would have happened had Taylor not randomly emailed you out of the blue? Oh,
man. Yeah. You ever do these weird things that like unsettle you? Like, you ever thought about what if this didn't happen and I didn't meet my spouse, Like,
yeah.
I tend to like not want to go there because I'm like, no, that makes me feel icky and I avoid those. So he and I will talk. I read through our old emails and it's hilarious. And they cracked me up. But at the end of the day, it worked out and it still works out. Like, he and I we still work super well together. And so you hear all these stories of, partners or whatever, and how they kind of things go sour or whatever. And for us, it's like gotten better. So I feel like we kind of got lucky. And I don't know what would happen. I think I'd probably just be a partner, like stressed and fat at an accountant.
Yeah.
But no, just kidding. Yeah. But yeah, maybe it wouldn't have worked for me and I would have jumped to something else, because I did feel like the accounting was the wrong, like it wasn't creative enough. Which, like, dude, you didn't know that going in? Come on. But anyway, so.
Yep. So a couple of years back, you guys, you had been doing YNAB, on the business model wise, you were charging just one-off stuff, right? Yeah. I mean, like, there was never
a license deal. Yeah.
So, but did anybody, were there even like upgrades that they would pay for, or is
it
just...
Yeah, like every couple of years we would push out like a number upgrade, like 3 to 4. And we'd charge, charge for that.
Gotcha. So then a couple of years ago, you guys shifted from that sort of one-off model to a subscription model.
Yeah.
And I think if I recall, the feedback from that was mixed.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. One way. And you're like, in my side gig, I work in politics, polishing up statements. And no,
right.
We had selected people as customers that were comfortable with the perpetual license model, right? So, like, by definition, you're working in a pool that maybe has a little bit of a stronger feeling against a subscription. Yeah. And we knew we would get backlash from that. And we did. It wasn't nearly as it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. But it was still, even if it's a loud minority, it's very hard to take, We're used to having people say how great YNAB is and how it's changed their life, and suddenly they were saying like, you're money grabbing, and I'm thinking, that's actually not what I'm doing, like, I'm trying to get something sustainable for the long haul. I like, writing was on the wall for us with that old model and what we were doing. It doesn't bode well. And so, yeah, we did make the switch. It was brutal. We made the switch right at the end of 2015, like 2 days before the end of the year. Mm-hmm. And it was brutal. And then all last year, we were just trying to survive. And now this year, it's better. So
what was the – I mean, obviously, you've got – from a financial standpoint, like, how quickly – or I guess has it made sense to make that switch to the subscription model? I mean, like has the revenue caught up where, obviously was the right decision, or like, you guys still trying to navigate that?
Our revenue was flat from like 15 to 16. So 15 was perpetual license, 16 was SaaS. and revenue is essentially flat, which for me was a massive victory because we were anticipating.
You were afraid you were going to lose it all, or
oh yeah,
lot
I mean,
of it at least.
Well, we were we were like, okay, now we're deferring revenue for you know, and we originally launched with a monthly plan and an annual plan, and then end of last year, so after basically 1 year under our belt, I nixed the monthly plan. Not a lot of people were using it, and I wanted people to be like, no, I'm serious about this. Like, I really want to change my behavior. And we give refunds and all that if people really change their mind. But it just allowed them to be like, no, I'm really buying in, and it's been a boost. So that did help with the cash flow bit. But you're still sitting there wondering, like, okay, what's churn going to look like? And you don't. I mean, you can predict all you want, and of course, you know all about this. But at the end of the day, you got to wait and see if the person's going to if they're going to re up or not. And that's what we were doing all last year. It was kind of wondering.
So. Yeah. So do you still feel like it was the right decision?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's going to let us do so much more on the service side for our customer base that it was, I mean, I don't want to say a slam dunk because it was brutal, but it was the right move. Yeah.
Do you feel like the pitchforks have kind of died down?
Yeah. That about halfway through last year, I thought, okay, things are starting to kind of go back to normal. Now the pitchforks are out because we're so slow on a mobile release. That's not from 2010, you know?
Right.
So we're excited for what's coming there because we'll finally, I feel like that's, well, it's classic. Like, oh, once we, that's what I'm doing here. Once we get this mobile out, then I feel like we'll really have an offering that people can't say there are like glaring holes. Everyone has their pet this or that need, but I feel like mobile is kind of our last gaping hole that we're going to patch up.
So, you know, Baremetrics is obviously in the B2B space and you're firmly in the B2C space. And I think like we get the occasional emotional user. But the,
I'm
the little
the
bit,
political phrases. How do you do it?
Well, I think so the B2C space though makes me really uncomfortable.
Oh, it should.
And I think it's because the reason I guess I'm treading lightly is I have operated B2C stuff in the past, and man, just you've got passionate users. In that space. And so I'm curious how you guys handle. I mean, I assume it's every day you get people who are just like, oh my gosh, you've changed my life, and you've also got like, oh my gosh, you guys are, you know, the spawn of Satan.
Yes. Yeah. We don't have too many of the Satan comments now, but, okay. If you're in a space where you're fixing people's money stress, like it is emotional.
Right.
Period. Right.
Cause you got people who are like, you know, on the verge of losing it all or losing their marriage. Yeah. Or, I mean, you know, like.
Exactly. Sure. So you're like, you are in the thick of the thickest of emotions. And then when you do something right or wrong, I mean, we've made plenty of mistakes as well. So it's not like it's just people overreacting. Like sometimes, you know, we make big mistakes, but when you've made a mistake in someone's eyes, perceived or real, it's rough for them, you know? Yep. And it was a good reminder for me to recognize, like, listen, people are really buying in to this experience and you need to respect that. We can disagree on what features should be next and all that. But if you go in with just this very healthy amount of respect for the caring, and essentially it's a really good quality to have in your customers because they're caring, they're talking about your product, they're spreading the word. But with, you know, it's like the Spider-Man thing, with great caring comes great responsibility for your customers as well. And you just have to kind of, I don't know, double down on really figuring out like, what they need and really hearing them and really trying to help, like genuinely trying to help them. There are some where you just say, you know, I've got to let you go. I've got to fire you as a customer.
Yeah.
But the overwhelming majority, we hire people that genuinely want to help people manage their money better. And it ends up working out. So change is brutal, but that goes away. You just want to make sure that you are at your core, genuinely invested in your customer success, business or consumer. And I feel like, you'll make mistakes and there'll be some painful spots, but in the end you can sleep well at night. But would I start another business? Would I go B2C? No way. B2B all the way.
Absolutely not. So in the like a personal finance and budgeting space, I mean, you've got like the Dave Ramseys and the Susie Ormans and like even like Mr. Money Mustache.
Yeah.
Like how there's obviously like tons of people selling. I guess a lot of these people started more in the like personal finance advice and like they have kind of, you think of like Dave Ramsey, who's like
launched into competitive software. Product for us. Yeah.
Right. Right. So like that space, like how do you, is it just like the market's so big because every single person has money that they need to manage, so it's not a big deal? Or do you find that like it is a highly competitive space?
Oh, it's overwhelmingly saturated with competitors.
Yeah.
I love Dave Ramsey, so I happily compete with him in the sense that if someone doesn't like us and they go to him, I'm like, hey, you know, the world's a little better. And the same, I don't know if he would say this, but if someone loves Dave, but they don't quite like his software, they like our software a little more and they come to us, I'm thinking, hey, we're net, you know, it's a net win.
Yeah.
There are, where I compete and I love stealing customers is with like Intuit, you know, with the Mint team. Because I feel like they're, that it's like a David versus Goliath feel. So I happily try and go after it. But there are so many new entrants into the market all the time, the fintech space, that you almost have to kind of keep your head down and just stick with your secret sauce. And because you can, I mean, man, you can think that you're supposed to build every single thing if you, you know, look up and look around a little bit. So we've had to really just focus on what we know we do well and leave the rest for everyone else to kind of duke it out.
Well, you think of like iOS apps, like anybody can just like knock out a random, what they think is some amazing way to make
Here's
money.
Another checkbook register. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But it looks real sweet.
So I mean, there's a lot of noise, but we do well in the education/caring space.
Yep.
So software is how we monetize our education.
Sure.
And it does help us stay focused on, again, like where we really have proficiency. I mean, we do well in software, but compared to our competitors, I would say we're slightly better. On the education caring side, I feel like we're head and shoulders above our competitors there, and that's where we kind of differentiate.
Gotcha. So can you, I guess, tell me about the day, or I don't know, maybe it was like over the course of a year or maybe not at all, that you realized like, hey, we're on to something.
Oh yeah. Boy, I would say that's more gradual than anything else. But toward the end of last year, I started thinking, okay, if this works out, like if we can survive this year and just keep kind of mixing the secret sauce, we could really be a force for good here. Like we could make an impact. 12 years after I started it.
And I had that, feel like,
yeah.
Like, yay.
I've always loved the space. So I've been happily writing about it, shooting videos about it, podcasting about, you know, personal finance and budgeting and all that. I love the topic. But last year it was like, oh wait, this is a company with a team, with people that like we could do more than just, you know, sell budgeting software and advice. We could have a place to work that people would, I don't know, that there's more good to be done here than just in the software side. Like there's something internal that's interesting. And that's kind of been what's on my mind more lately, is the company itself as a little bit of a product.
Gotcha. So, and I guess sort of jumping off that, was there, I remember back in, you know, you talked about something like in the early days where you saw these big increases in profit. Was there, what were some other ones, I guess, recently, or have there been any in the past, say, 5 to 8 years where like growth really changed? Like you did something that changed growth a lot for you guys.
Funny one, we are no longer doing this, but we launched our budgeting app on Steam several years ago. So that was way funny. And
One of our Call of Duty and
exactly. You need a budgeting. Call of Duty. So we, one of our developers was like, hey, Valve has this opportunity for non, like a little bit of an experiment for non-game software. And we were like, come on, seriously? So he goes, what if I just do it all? Like I get it ready in the, you know, I get the build ready and I get it all tied into their system. And we said, sure, yeah, let's do that. And then we sold it on Steam, and it didn't really do a lot, but then Steam said, well, we want to do like this promotion and we want to sell it. And we were selling it for $60 and they said, we want to sell it for 15. It was like a 48 hour sale. Okay. And I'm like, that's no, I don't, I'm not going to discount my software. It's worth, it's people get way more value out of it than even $60. And they were like, listen, you just, you want to do it. And we did it and it was insane. The volume, like it's the level of irony is not lost on me where people are impulse purchasing a budgeting app.
Sure. But
that was exactly what was happening. And so then we were mortified that we would just get overwhelmed with support. And of course it was total crickets, like nothing had happened. And the reason was because people just, it's like they bought it just to be like, oh, I might use that some at some point, you know, so they'd buy it. And so that was this hilariously profitable venture, cost us no extra money. We launched on Steam and it moved the needle for us for 2 years. We would do them every once in a while. And it really funded a lot of our growth for, you know, when we had to kind of double down on this SaaS model and rewrite everything. Steam helped us fund it quite a bit. So
that's so random, man.
Yeah, it was. I mean, and so people are like, well, this one guy in this one podcast, he said we should be on Steam. That is not what I'm saying, but it was just funny. So it's worth sharing. But.
Oh, man. So the inverse of the growth or being onto something, what's been a time that you guys thought like, nope, this is not, this will not work. Like the end is near.
Where I thought things were in jeopardy.
Yeah.
I haven't had that feeling. I had in end of 09 when Taylor and I were basically just the two of us doing everything. I remember running up a credit card for the last like 30 days before we were going to launch the third version. And we were hustling. And Taylor was working like almost day and night. And we had to get it out before the end of the year because we told our customers that we would, and you should never do that. But we got it out. And so I floated about 30 grand of credit card debt for about 25 days during that time. And I didn't even realize I had done it. So I was always using a business card just for normal expenses. And then you just pay it off, you know, immediately. Yeah. And that was that. And I go to pay the card and I look at the checking account. This is hilarious coming from a financial guy, but it was just like, oh, wait, I can't pay that. And so I paid just the minimum, which was insane. And I realized at the point, like I depleted my personal emergency fund already. Julie and I had cut back like everything under the sun. And then we were running up this card. And that was the second most stressful time in the business. But that stress lasted for 3 weeks. I knew we had a launch date, right? And I knew we had customers that would buy the app. So it was temporary. Last year, when we moved to the SaaS model, that was more stressful because you didn't know for a long time. You know, we had to like, there's just a lot of waiting and seeing. But I never felt like things were, you know, we were on a precipice or anything like that. I think I operate pretty conservatively in that way. So we had saved up a lot of money. We knew things would be tight. And we were going to ride it out that way.
Do you feel like you're the kind of guy who just doesn't, is it that you're not stressed out about things, or is it that you've sort of planned or set yourself up so that you don't get stressed?
It's the latter. So you're constantly like leaving breadcrumbs behind wherever you're going, right? So if you're planning on going full time, you're setting money aside. You're going to give yourself this runway. If you're, you know, planning on switching business models, your business better be setting money aside. And I've just always done that. Even with YNAB and then me personally, like, of course, if you're a founder of a company, the odds are the vast amount of your net worth or whatever, liquid or not, is wrapped up in your company. But I've always tried to just be like, okay, what safety net can I kind of weave here behind the scenes just in case everything goes south. So I do, I've done stuff just over the last 6, 7, 8 years to kind of be crafting that safety net just in case. Mm-hmm. And so I'd say it's much more of like the planner that isn't stressed than it is just being aloof. I'm certainly not aloof.
Yeah. Gotcha. So what's coming up for I guess you and YNAB? I mean, you mentioned the mobile stuff, but I mean,
yeah. So product wise, a mobile deal will be coming later this year. That's where it's standalone. You can never know we have a web app and still do really well with the software. So that's a big deal for us. Yep. Company wise, we're going to North Carolina at the beginning of next month for a big company wide retreat that we do once a year. So I'm actually really excited about that. And then I was really intrigued by this deal out in Maine where they can teach you in 2 weeks how to build a house. So trying to figure out how I can weave that in, because that sounds interesting. So yeah, but that's the kind of the stuff that I'm looking forward to. And I love the team. Like, the team seems to be really effective together, and we're building this product that is the company that I'm really starting to be proud of. So
sure. No, so you guys have a central office, right? Or
yeah, there's three of us here. Like,
okay.
Yeah, and then there are, I think, maybe 55 other people that are spread everywhere.
And so all 55-ish are meeting up in North Carolina?
We do the full-timers for the meetup. Yeah, kind of a full-timer reward.
Gotcha. What part-time people? How many part-time people do you have?
Probably maybe 28.
Oh, wow. So what kind of stuff are they doing?
They do support and education. Like, we run probably, I haven't looked lately, but usually per week we run like 130 workshops, all live. So that, we have these educators that do that. And then we also have just people on email support, or we're testing out some live chat support. And there, we really want to get our response times just
really low.
Like crazy low, where our competitors are like, they're using wizardry. You know, you couldn't.
Sure. So wait, what's the benefit of having, say, like a dozen part-time support people instead of like six full-time?
We actually have a mix of some full-time that are, and there is an advantage there that we're just starting to appreciate, around just kind of knowledge continuity and connection. So we have shift managers, and we really make sure that, like, people are like working a specific block of time so that we cover our support queue. And we use the full-timer support folks to kind of orchestrate that, where a part-time person, it's a good gig for a lot of people where they're like, well, I don't want to work full-time. I'd love to just, work this from home. Maybe like, it's during your kids are at school or something. You don't have to travel. There's so many benefits to the remote work that I don't have to tell you. And I love being able to give someone a job that's like, it's good pay. It's very rewarding work, and it's convenient at the same time. So
sure. That makes sense. Yeah. I can see, doing the, especially if you're trying to cover a wide range of times on something like support, full-time staffing, say 24 hours, 24/7 support is really expensive.
Yeah. You start looking at different time zones and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Gotcha. Cool. Well, man, that is all I have got.
Excellent.
Thanks for having a call.
Yeah. Whoever's listening, hopefully they get, at least some little nugget out of it. I don't think rollerblading is coming back, so I don't think that
will
do the job, but
I don't know. Maybe now. Maybe now it will.
We'll see.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was fun. Thanks, Josh. I appreciate it.
Cool. Thanks, Jesse. Have a good one.
See ya.
All right, there we have it. Jesse Meacham of You Need a Budget. If you want to learn more about You Need a Budget, head to, wait for it, youneedabudget.com. Thanks for listening this week. If you need revenue analytics and insights, check out baremetrics.com. If you have any feedback, I'd love to hear it. Shoot me an email, josh@baremetrics.com, or on Twitter @Spigvard. Head to founderchats.com to listen to a heaping pile of other conversations with startup founders. And if you enjoyed this, a rating on iTunes or sharing this with your friends really does go a long way. Thanks again.